sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Boeing gets shellacked. Gold surges. Earnings season is kicking off in big-time gear this week. And we have guests John Markman and Steve Randy Waldman. All this and so much more on episode number 321 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hey, how are you? I don't know if you missed me, but I missed you. I took a week off. Yes, I did have a nice vacation. Spent some time in Morocco and Portugal. And if you haven't been to Morocco, man, that's some place to be. I got to tell you something. It was an unbelievable trip. You know, I'll tell you a little bit about it. I want to get too involved. I'll try to put some pictures up on the web as well. But man, I got to tell you, the camel rides at sunset through the Sahara with the, what color was that? It was a rustic orange, golden, thin, very fine sand everywhere was incredible. The markets in Marrakesh, amazing. The spices, the cooking classes. We try to do something every year that's a little bit out of the ordinary. And this year, I can definitely qualify this one as way out of the ordinary. It was not only a different culture, but the heat was oppressive. The people were really nice. I got to tell you something. They were just great. Helpful. Our guide, Hamid, was wonderful. And, you know, it's interesting to be in a country that is basically a government that runs by a religious edict. And there was a lot of things that happened. It was right before Ramadan, for example. And we went out to dinner one night and we brought and asked our guide to come with us. And he did. And they wouldn't serve him any alcohol because, I guess, 30 days or so before Ramadan, you got to clear out and clean out. And then what you had was a big confusion because he said he's not religious. So we left and we went somewhere else and they said the same thing. Meanwhile, they'll serve us, but they won't serve him. It's kind of a crazy thing. And we talked about it and he said, you know what, he really doesn't want to push it because it could be 3 months in jail for disobeying the law, which is obviously religious law, that is in power for the country in total. And it's also interesting to find out that he's tried to get a visa to go visit other countries. And while he can get some for certain areas around the world, US and Japan and a few others around the world, Europe, he can't get a visa. It's a lottery. Doesn't know if he can get it. And it's kind of so much opposite of what we live in is free market and economy and a free society where we can do what we want, practice whatever religion we want or not. And it was a real eye-opener. But it was very hot. It was very dusty. It was very much amazing. Morocco, quite the place to be. Portugal, I'm not so thrilled. Very expensive and lovely, but yet didn't have as much of the incredible feeling that I got when I was in for, say, Italy, Spain, and some other countries around the world within Europe. But there's a lot we're going to talk about. We have some great guests on today, and I wanted to kind of go over some of the things that happened last week and some of the things we should be looking for this week. You know, we saw the beginning of earnings season with Alcoa come out with earnings and not do much. You know, they had a kind of a lukewarm number. And then, as Alcoa usually does, it moves up after hours after the number and then it just starts coming back in the next few days. Nothing really exciting about Alcoa on either side. They're kind of holding their own, and it's, I find it fascinating that with all of the good numbers we're seeing with cars and with other types of things that are used, that aluminum goes into, how difficult of a time that Alcoa is having, the steel companies that are having, the material companies overall are having. And on the opposite side of the spectrum, we see services doing so well, and we see that that there is a pocket of stocks that are related to the consumer and manufacturing that are doing very well. And I think that what that says to us, not only domestically here in the United States, but also around the world, is that we're in changing times. The technology has taken over, that we are much more involved in those kind of devices and that kind of spending than we are, in fact, with things that are big, bulky, and need to be manufactured. So I think we need to watch that as a theme throughout the next quarter and throughout this earnings season. And there's a lot of companies that are coming out this week. We already saw the Alcoa I mentioned. We saw JP Morgan, which are the two biggies for that week. We have this week coming up a whole slew of companies that are really going to set the tone. We'll see what their outlook is, because last quarter, if you remember, many of the companies did, in fact, guide down, and investors really didn't believe it and said, hey, it will be better. And maybe they're just being a little overreactive to what they're seeing on a slowdown around the world. And they bid it up. And yet at the same time, like we see a lot of times, in between earnings season, from that 1.5 month period where it really dies down and then starts coming back up, markets did in fact sell off. I think a top to bottom was about 7%. Much of that was blamed on Bernanke for his comments about the tapering, which of course he backtracked on and walked backwards last week on. And we saw a big turnaround in things like gold. Gold shot up, I think, about 100 points from the low point and really did amazing. I think I mentioned a couple of times on the show that we have to watch for those miners. There was a couple of days those miners did awful last week, but then surged about 25% over about a two-day period. And that just goes to show that there is an incredible amount of emphasis put on what the Fed is going to do. Regardless of what Japan does, Europe does, and everywhere else around the world, the fact of the matter is the Fed is, in the U.S., is very much important for around the world. Now, if you look at the same time, what's going on in Brazil, they raised their interest rate again because inflation is out of control. That market's down about 25% this year. And that country does a lot in the area of oil. And what's amazing is oil hit 106 last week, which is bizarre. We still see a very high amount of inventories. I've been talking about how I thought it was overpriced to begin with. Then you throw in this pipeline issue that happened, and of course what's going on in the Middle East with Egypt, and the speculators just have a field day with it. It's an absolute field day. The green light is just, hey, go and buy. In fact, we saw it dropping down a little bit on Thursday into Friday, and then a big turnaround on Friday for no apparent reason, even with the dollar moving higher. So the correlations that we're used to seeing between bonds and stocks and gold and the dollar and the oil and the dollar and the rest of the world and consumption is really kind of not there right now. There seems to be a continued push into stocks because they can, because there's not many alternatives. So that's really what's going on right there. But the gold speculators did pick up their overall allocation. Look at the commitment of traders at the end of last week and after Bernanke spoke on Thursday and said not much of anything at a very obscure meeting. When he was asked about tapering, markets went bananas. Overnight, they surged. This was actually Wednesday night. Overnight, they surged, and then Thursday, they came up and continued to move up, which is really interesting. We hit an all-time high again in the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones Industrial Average and like a 13-year high in the NASDAQ. Quite amazing, considering that last week or the week before or so, it looked like that things were just going to kind of be stagnant. Everybody's going to be waiting for earnings season to come around to see what they were going to do. But nope, just like we've seen this market before, and I think we'll see it again, we're seeing that choppiness where we have a slow drift down and then a two-day rally that pretty much takes back all the losses that may have happened. And as we continue to hit those high levels that are in that noisy resistance area, we're going to have to watch what happens from here, because earnings season, I'm telling you right now, is going to be the key to all of this. We've also seen a lot of M&A activity, mergers and acquisition. On Friday, after the bell, we saw that AT&T bought Leap Wireless for about a 90% premium. There was some comment that Roche would buy, at least was looking to buy, Alexion Pharmaceuticals, a stock that we actually hold. It was as high as, I think, 25% out of nowhere in the middle of the day on Friday. Came back a bit. I think it finished up about 13% or so. But still, there is a lot of speculation out there that the low interest rate environment is allowing for companies to borrow at ridiculously low levels and therefore doing a few things. Doing a tremendous amount of stock buybacks. And also what they're doing is looking for acquisitions that can be accretive to earnings. So what's happening is with the markets is, yes, there is some retail participation, definitely some hedge fund participation for swing trades, et cetera. But you're also seeing a tremendous amount of companies actually going in and buying their stocks and also looking for acquisition candidates. And that's really part of the underpinning of the current market environment right now. So there's a few other things that are happening. I want to go over some of the economics because there's a lot coming up next week. We have China on Sunday night, later, towards about 10 o'clock or so. So by the time you're listening to this, it's probably going to pass. Looking for about a 7.5% rate of GDP. Now, that is a bit lower than has been the expectations, and there's already comments coming out from many of the, we'll call them the finance ministers of China. And what they're talking about is, I think what they're doing is they're trying to prepare the markets for a low number. Now, low, what I mean low is it may not be under the expectations, but low compared to where we have seen the traditional markets on GDP, and that is a big concern. You know, one of the things that happened was that they're starting to restate some of their numbers, their import exports. They are not going to be doing a breakout of many of the different regions' PMI numbers and a few other things. And who knows what we're really going to understand and know about China moving forward, because they are starting to either pay attention to their economics and trying their best to make it so that they're consistent and reliable, or they're involved in a lot of shenanigans, and what they're doing is really trying to hide how slow their economy really is. There's a lot of things happening that investors are still ignoring. For example, we saw the sovereign debt rating of Italy get dropped. France finally lost its Fitch rating of AAA, the final rating agency, to drop France's AAA level, and that was something that, if you remember, a year ago I was very concerned about, and that really didn't play out because the ECB stepped in and, you know, did their little magic. But at this point, I think that that when we're looking at Europe, we have to realize that there still is a tremendous amount of illiquidity, banking problems, and still a tremendous amount of overbuilding that has to be flushed out of the system. A real big problem there. Well, coming up this week, we have a lot of banks. There's probably 15 or 16 banks that are coming up in earnings next week. I put a list of key earnings on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. If you look at the show notes for this particular show, and anytime, by the way, if you want to find out some of the things we talked about, the people that were on the show, and anything that relates to a particular show, you just go over to the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com. On the top there, you click podcasts, and you just get the whole list of podcasts. The week that you're listening to is always on the front page to the left, and you can see very clearly the basic summary of what happened. Then you click that, and you can find all the other information that's available and some other things. We put some links on this week's show so that you could find exactly what we're talking about. And some of the topics that we're talking about, a link to the earnings sheet so you can see what the expectations for earnings and revenues, EPS and revenues are, as well as some information about our guests. So you need to kind of every once in a while take a look at that. But let's talk about some of the earnings, the economics that are coming up, because it's very important. We have retail sales that are coming up on Monday at 8:30 in the morning. We have retail sales less autos looking for about a 0.5% increase. Overall, the advanced retail sales are looking for a 0.8% increase, which is not in the level of a real growth phase, but it's still stable and better than last month's. So that's good. We also have on Tuesday CPI coming out. PPI came out a little bit hot on Friday, actually, if you saw that. And usually what happens is that CPI will follow. There really is no inflation to speak of when you strip out all the excess, like, you know, oil and food. there really is not a lot of inflation right now. And that's why Bernanke could be so just absolutely, whether it's bullheaded or he's so consistent about his message about continuing with stimulus. And it's pretty amazing if you really just step back and think about it. We wrote about this again this quarter in our quarterly newsletter that we send out to our clients. And it's pretty amazing how all of this money from around the world has flooded markets, and yet there's still no significant inflation in any of the developed countries around the world. I mean, I find that to be almost an impossibility. And that's why gold was going up and silver was going up for so long. And then we saw that big sellout, which was pretty much a flush down below the 1200 level. And that was a time when it was clear that a lot of people were starting to panic about what was going on, because the precipitous drop that we saw prior to that for about a month or two. But we're going to see what CPI come out, and we'll see what happens. With PPI came out a little bit hot, gold did pop again, and we'll see if the same thing happens, if there is an inflation concern that happens. That would be very bad for the Fed, because now they're caught in a big quandary. Already their back is up against the wall. They really don't want interest rates to rise, even though mortgage rates have the highest they've been in, I don't know, a very long time. And at the same time, they want to make sure that they don't overstimulate the economy and create another bubble of any sort. And yet they know how sensitive and reactionary the market is to anything they say about limiting stimulus. So they're really between a rock and a hard place. Now, Bernanke, I am sure, wants to leave his mark on things and end on a high note. It looks like he's going to be retiring from the Fed as chairman at the end of this year. Larry Summers put his hat in the ring. Forget about that. That I don't think is going to happen. But when we see some of the other things that are going to be coming out this week, like industrial production on Tuesday. Tuesday's a very big day. There's a lot of things happening. Monday and Tuesday are big days for economics. Then we have on Thursday the housing market index, the sentiment of builders that will be coming out. We have housing starts, building permits, and then, of course, initial jobless claims and leading indicators on Friday. So there's a big week for economics and for earnings, and this is all going to converge. Now, what I'll tell you is that there are some opportunities that you could probably find that are going to be very significant, and definitely during earnings season. We put some videos up. I think I told you that for Trigger Point Research, where we have the alert services, we started doing a setups video, a video series about twice a week or so, that shows some of the stocks that may be setting up, that may be looking like they're getting ripe, and telling you and explaining what we're looking at, why we're saying it, and giving you a little bit more substance underneath all of that. If you go to Trigger Point Research, you can find that under the videos on the right-hand side, or during this episode, I put on this episode's show notes as well. You can click there and look at the video. We did one on Green Mountain Coffee Roasters, which looks like it was falling through a significant potential, we call it drop zone. And when you look at that, you'll see what I'm talking about from the video and how it actually, we've painted where those drop zones are. And it did, in fact, fall pretty well after we had sent out that alert last week. So that was kind of, I think, interesting to look at. It's something that you want to take a look at. So make sure you can actually subscribe on the YouTube channel, by the way. So you can see that they're about 3 or 4 or 5 minutes long and tells you exactly what we're looking for and what we're looking at. Before we get to our guests, I want to mention also that we have, I think next week, we're going to make the big announcement about TradeStation. We had one that was coming and some preliminary things that we did with them, but we have a whole new set of indicators that are going to be up there, new prices. And I think you're going to like that, as well as the fact that, you know, I just looked on their website. They're giving away their platform fees are waived through the end of this year. So you got like 6 months of free platform fees. Even if you want to play with it with delayed data, it doesn't cost you anything. It's like nothing. That's pretty cool. So you can kind of check out some of the indicators that we have and do that. And if you want information on that, I'll try to put that up on the website somewhere. Just go to tradestation.com and you can check it out as well. So I think that what we'll do is we will get to our guests and have, since we have two of them on, and have a conversation and talk and see what they have to say. And then we'll close it up with some of the things that are happening in terms of markets and also a couple of other news items that I got that I thought were interesting that I just want to repeat to you. Next week we have also a lot of listener questions. You could always write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And, well, let's get right to it. And back by popular demand, but not back as often as he should be, is John Markman, a good friend of mine, Markman Capital Management, as well as the publisher of Trader's Advantage and five books that are awesome to read. And we'll put all that information on the show notes for this episode. Mr. Markman, how are you?
Fantastic. Thank you. How are you?
Good. It's been a while since we have you on. We need your wisdom. We need your help. What are your thoughts on some of the things going on right now? For example, I know you recently wrote an article on MarketWatch that talked about bond volatility, which was pretty intense last month, right?
Yeah, bond volatility was pretty intense. And it stemmed from a misinterpretation amongst the players in the marketplace as to exactly when and how much the Fed is going to taper its asset purchases under the QE3 program. I think that the investors got it wrong at first, and now they've swung around to the right side. And I think there'll be a lot of volatility in between, but in the end, I think that everyone is going to realize that U.S. monetary policy will remain, loose for the foreseeable future, and that's going to keep U.S. and global bond yields, relatively low for longer than most people expect now.
Now, one of the things that is funny, because I hear that a lot, I hear that the markets got it wrong. And what's interesting is that oftentimes, or forever, the market is always right, number one. The collective wisdom of markets are what they are, and you can't have anything wrong. The markets do what they do, right? And at the same time, I wonder, did the markets get it wrong, number one? Number two, was it really all about that, or was just that kind of time between the earnings periods that usually see a little bit of a dip and summer coming and, rough months usually?
In a way, it's not so much that the markets get it wrong. It's that a lot of hedge funds and pension funds now have what they call parity trades on. Have you heard of parity trades?
Sure. Yeah, well, explain it, though, for everybody.
So a parity trade, just to be super glib about it, is are trades in which bonds and stocks are linked in a leveraged format. So such that investors are trying to arbitrage the differences between stock movements and bond movements. When they get out of whack, their algorithms know when they should come together, etc. The problem is that when there is no parity, or when correlations between stocks and bonds move to a new level that the algorithms haven't seen, they get a little haywire.
Yeah.
And when you're leveraged and you're going haywire, you can have some really big swings. And that's what I mean by the market getting it wrong. It's that some of these algorithms way overshot where the information should have allowed them to go, and then they've had to correct way back as well. It's like a big pendulum. So right now, although the market got it wrong at first, and it's in the process of getting it right.
Well, now let me ask something. It's interesting because we have seen a bizarre correlation, whereas usually, not exactly, but you'll see that, okay, stocks are up and bonds are down and vice versa. You have the safety trade, you have the kind of the risk trade, you have the fact that, you can't be buying all things at all times. What's really weird,
though. The algorithms expect bonds, that if stocks go down, bonds will go up.
Right.
But what happened last month was that stocks and bonds went down together. And so when that happens, these funds get way off sides on their margin, and they have to sell stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say that they have their margin leverage to their bond collateral, but then they have to sell off bonds in order to get their margin straight with the brokerages, and that leads to more stock selling, and the stock selling leads to more bond selling, and it just gets into this really vicious cycle until it wears itself out, or until some funds and other players can go broke.
Right.
And then it stops and goes the other direction.
Right.
And I think that's what's happening. That's what happened over the last 3 weeks.
Well, the other thing is that, is it possible, just possible, that, that's one potential explanation. Is it possible the markets got it right and then, kind of the take the water down and as opposed to raising the bridge for the boat? But is it possible that Bernanke backstepped on what he was saying? He realized that, he really was a little bit too not as transparent, or maybe too transparent, and he backstepped. And, it really, if you look at what happened this week, the movement of the markets on the comment was in an after-hours Q&A that was basically one comment about the tapering, and everything kind of blew up from there. So even
I heard a funny story about that.
Absolutely.
Well, apparently, and what you say is correct. It's interesting that here the Fed makes these comments, makes policy announcements in statements after their meeting. And then Bernanke gets on the podium afterwards and does his own statement in a Q&A. He also goes and makes official comments in front of Congress. And the Fed governors make their own comments to on the rubber chicken circuit, you know, at conferences. Mm-hmm. So you have all these official means of getting information out about what the Fed intends. But then you look at what happened 2 days ago. You know, Bernanke makes comments in an after-hours Q&A session after a speech before a relatively obscure conference in Boston. And it causes this dramatic reaction of a 150-point move in the Dow after hours. How can that possibly happen? You have all these official methodologies of getting information out. Why did the market trade so viciously on what ought to be an obscure release of information that was not important?
Mm-hmm.
But what I heard was that a lot of major fund managers were at a Goldman Sachs dinner that night, Wednesday night, and when the Bernanke comments came out, apparently one or two managers interpreted his comments dovishly,
mm-hmm.
and covered a big short bet that they had, and other fund managers heard about that. Other fund managers who were also short and had been wrong in their shorts jumped in and followed him.
Really?
And basically covered their shorts at the same time. And that's why you had like a 150-point move in the Dow after hours, seemingly out of nowhere.
And then you had how do you explain the follow-through?
Well, there hasn't been any follow-through.
No, I'm saying the next day it stayed. It didn't just kind of blow off.
Yes, but it stayed, but it didn't go anywhere.
Right. Well, what's interesting about that is that story may be funny and it may be total rumor and hyperbole, but the fact is that could also be just as easily true.
I think it is true, actually.
Really?
My source on that is very good.
Well, did they finish their dinner at least?
There's a lot of bizarre stuff that happens behind the scenes in the markets that mm-hmm. people probably don't really want to know.
Yeah, no, don't tell them either. It's like anything else. You know, you don't want to know all the gruesome details because it's kind of repulsive sometimes. Let's talk about gold. Now, one of the things that's really, I know that you've tracked gold, you follow gold and all, and obviously gold took a pretty good shellacking, so did silver. Now, one of the questions I have is really the cause of the sell-off. And you could say, well, it's because the correlation to the dollar has been rising. But I don't know. I mean, that's, you know, you don't see oil doing that and some other things. It hasn't really been following it. You don't see stocks doing that with the dollar rising. The question is, this all started, this kind of movement of gold started with the whole Cyprus issue where the comment was made that, hey, you know what, we're not going to fund everything. You got to participate too. And you know what? Maybe you have to sell some of your gold reserves. And everybody got a little spooked that governments may start selling their gold reserves. Then things started moving the other way, and the yen started going wacko with Abe and the Abenomics. Who are the big sellers of this gold? Because the big gold bugs really never sell. We know that Paulson is getting, I mean, I think his fund was down 63%, the gold fund down 63% year to date, 29% in June. Who are the sellers of this? It's got to be big.
They got to be big. And, you know, I am not a gold expert. I've never been a gold bug. I've never really understood the attraction that investors have for gold. However, I do know that one of my systems called the top in gold at the end of 2011. And that system called for a 5-year top in gold at that point. So we're looking for gold to travel, you know, lower and, you know, flat to lower over the next 5 years. And what that really means, you know, is that investors are looking for deflation. Now, I don't know who the big sellers are or why they are, but when gold and other commodities are signaling deflation, and that deflation probably comes from China.
Yeah, which is obviously they've guided down again, saying that, hell, you know, we could be fine at 7%. We're like, what? You know what, by the way, speaking of China, I think it's fascinating that, you know, all this time everybody's saying, hey, you know what, these import-export numbers look a little bit fishy, but you know what, you have to go with the information as best as possible. Then China comes out and says, hey, you know what, we think you're right. We think that there's some kind of weirdness going on in regards to the amount of money that has been moving in and out of the country, and maybe we're going to change our methodology. Now, they don't tell us how they're going to change the methodology. So when we see the export numbers come down to negative 1%, is it a comparison against the wrong numbers? Is it a comparison against the right numbers? You know what I'm saying? When you compare it, then we hear that they fell again. And, you know, China was excited for a day because they think there's going to be more stimulus. And then at the same time, we're saying now they're not going to be putting out their PMI numbers because it's too difficult to kind of put it all together.
Well, you know, I think that the what you're seeing in China is similar to what we call the presidential cycle in the United States. You know how we know in the presidential cycle that the first couple of years of a presidency tend to be the worst in terms of the economy and the stock market, because particularly when it's a new president, because he basically backtracks on everything that the previous president has done, and sets the market up for a success in his reelection year. And I think that what we're seeing in China is something very similar. You've had a change in the leadership there, and the new leadership, who of course were elected by the same people who were elected the old leadership. But be that as it may, the new leadership is trying to get the country right-sided, and they in a way that they can blame all the previous government officials. So it looks to me like, you know, they're finally going to make some of the tough choices on austerity, reducing the amount of credit, reducing the overspending, the over capacity issues, and you know, I think there could be a 2 to 3 year correction, you know, in China while that happens.
I wonder if they'll stop spending their money on whiskey, the governors and the finance ministers.
So what's interesting for us is that, you know, China has been the source of inflation in certain regards over the last couple of years, and now China will be the source of deflation. So I think that those two ideas kind of work together. The gold is signaling deflation, and the actions in China are also signaling deflation. And right. What's interesting about this for us is that, let's just say that the 10-year correlation between U.S. markets and the emerging markets has decoupled, which I think it has.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where U.S. markets are finally doing good, well, and the emerging markets are doing poorly. Well, that means that you could have something really very, very cool in the United States. You could have economic growth, not great economic growth, maybe 2.5% growth, but you could have that growth for the first time in my lifetime without inflation.
Which would obviously be a net growth, so you wouldn't have a real adjusted growth. It'd have, because inflation is nothing. You know, you have it where
the big difference, Andrew, would be that price earnings multiples could actually levitate, because when inflation is low, investors have more confidence about the future and are willing to bid up the earnings multiples of stocks. You could have both. You could have growth of, let's say, 7 to 15% in earnings growth, and you have the secret lever of rising price to earnings ratios as well, and that can get you a pretty good stock market for the next couple of years.
Well, let's kind of end it on this. I want to ask you about S&P 500 earnings. Now, what we've been seeing is that the earnings game, we know how that plays out, and who knows what's going on with the banks. Let's not even talk about that, because I can't figure those out for the life of me, the differentials. Mm-hmm. But and there's so much embedded. But when we talk about S&P 500 earnings, ex financials, we're looking at a much lower growth rate than we saw maybe 6 months ago, which is at least the expectations. But the problem that I've been seeing is that revenues have really been slowing down. And in fact, this way may be one of the first quarters in a while where we see negative revenue growth. The question I have is,
I think negative revenue growth is actually actually the opposite of growth. Contraction.
Right. Well, it depends. If you're a if you're a newspaper, you got to put it that way. You got to say that growth is less than was expected in the normal. In the parlance of normality and the way we should talk about it, the fact is we have obviously lower earnings than we've had previously. Now revenues. How can we continue to see margin expansion, PE multiple expansion potentially, and earnings EPS net bottom line better with a better hiring situation? And how does it all work together?
Yeah, so inflation makes a lot of things possible, and inflation makes investors more confident about the future. So that's where you get, just to be very clear, that's where improved price earnings multiples come from. And you're talking about the S&P 500, and the S&P 500 is primarily what we primarily talk about when we talk about S&P 500 is we're really thinking about the S&P 100, which is the big caps, the mega caps within the index. Those companies are the most levered to overseas development, so Europe, selling to Europe, Latin America, and China. Well, if those areas are not performing well, you know, those big caps could actually have trouble meeting their bogeys. And that's why I think that we're really looking at a period now where small caps can shine again, much as they did in the early 2000s when the big cap indexes struggled. The small caps actually did very well.
Yep,
small
sure
cap small cap stocks are much more levered to the domestic economy. You're talking about, let's say retail chains that sell mostly to U.S. customers, all kinds of smaller businesses, whether they're technology firms or industrial manufacturers. So what I'm actually thinking about is that small cap growth in particular, could have a really nice move higher over the next couple of years.
Interesting.
As we see lower inflation and a stronger U.S. economy with lower refined oil costs due to the increase in energy from the oil shale fields.
Yeah. I mean, that would be good. Listen, John Markman, who, again, he has some great newsletters. If you're looking for some actually has some trials that you can take out with the Strategem and Trader's Advantage and all the different things over at Markman Capital.
Advantage.
Yeah, and the futures, of course, the Gemini program as well. So I will put some links right to your website, and I do encourage my listeners, because I read your stuff, and it's awesome. And I encourage you to at least take out a trial and see what's going on with it, so you can, you know, see what it is. And clearly, depending on what kind of trader you are, you'll see what the depth of knowledge and the opportunities that you have when working with my friend Mr. Markman. So I thank you.
Thanks for asking you to say.
All right, we'll talk to you soon, buddy.
All right, take care.
All right, bye.
Bye.
And we have another guest, actually, first timer on with us today, Steve Randy Waldman, who writes a interesting blog. A conversation. It's called interfluidity.com, and I wanted to talk about a variety of things, because he writes some very interesting things regarding, well, government, politics, economy, and all that. So, Steve, how are you, buddy?
I'm good. How are you?
I am fine, thanks. Let's talk about a few things, you know, just kind of touch on a few things that I've seen you write about. One of the things you've been talking about, I think, more recently is, you know, this whole NSA thing and Snowden and, you know, What is the real importance of this? Is this a whole, like, Big Brother uncovering? Is there something else that's deeper than this? I mean, why should we be concerned about this?
Yeah, I think there really is something else that's very deep about it. I think it dovetails with economic issues as well. Ultimately, the problem of having a decent society is a thing that plays out in time. And so when we look at economic issues like inequality, and people use sort of hyperbolic analogies and talk about neo-feudalism. Well, obviously, we're not a feudal society, but there are trends and there are sort of social institutions that are fraying that make the hyperbolic claim of neo-feudalism something to genuinely worry about. And in the same way, the NSA stuff, it's obviously true that the United States today is not Stasi East Germany. But the reason for that is no longer because there are sufficient checks on what's going on that makes it impossible for the U.S. to become Stasi East Germany. It's just because at the moment, the capabilities that are out there are not being used to create a society like Stasi East Germany. And both in the economic sphere and in the political sphere, the surveillance issues, I think the main problem of our time is that we're kind of stepping onto a sliding board. And slippery slope arguments you can always make forever, but I mean a sliding board sort of very specifically, not a slippery slope in the sense of, well, maybe if something happens, something else will happen. There are a lot of reasons to think that there's a built-in dynamic in continuing inequality and in continuing surveillance power that will take us to a society that we genuinely don't want. Inequality creates more social strife as it continues. Groups that are doing relatively well in more and more unequal societies become genuinely frightened. It's not that they're tyrants or evil people. I think that's a thing that's worth keeping in mind, even about East Germany. The people who invented communism were idealists, and they were caught in their own social dynamic until they became very directly and clearly evil. But every step along that way was people first trying to do good things and then being frightened.
Now, but see, let me just interrupt you. I mean, the thing is, you say why we're not Stasi Germany. I mean, I think the differential is we have much more information available to us today, and pretty much, you know, been if not for anything, just look at Facebook, where people divulge information like never before freely, in a way that is more personal and more clearly identifiable to a person than, you know, just a simple census that they took in Germany in those years. The difference is that the powers that be are not utilizing it at this moment to do anything, as you say, evil with it. At the same time, you mentioned that this problem of inequality. I have an issue with this because I'm really, you know, from an economic standpoint, from a global standpoint, from a historical standpoint, doesn't there in a generally balanced environment, there have to be haves and have nots, unless in theory you go to socialism or communism, which has not worked to create even the required amounts for everybody to share with. I mean, how do you have the opportunity to create total equality and at the same time have prosperity and innovation and all the other things that you want to have?
Well, absolutely. Right. So it's matters of degree. Total equality is just a terrible idea. It doesn't create incentives that humans need to create good societies. But it's a question of the scale of those incentives, right? Mm-hmm. So we had an unequal society in the U.S. in 1970. Right?
Okay.
Nobody would have accused us of being a communist society trying to have everybody at the same level. But the differential between the top 1% and the median was much, much more modest. And I think what you're looking at in the U.S., but not only in the U.S., this is really a global issue. The problem with really exaggerated inequality is that in 1970s U.S., we could have a lot of inequality, but putting aside some other very significant inequalities, like racial inequalities that were much less addressed than they are now, at an economic level, we could conceive of ourselves as a single society.
Mm-hmm.
But when inequality becomes so vast that the lived experience of different groups is dramatically different, it makes it very, very difficult to run a society for lots of different reasons. So one reason is simply that the various different groups don't have any real sense of what's going on
mm-hmm.
in other groups. They become socially isolated. Right, so wealthy people in the U.S., which is most of the people sort of involved in conversations on the blogosphere, people who would be listening to a Disciplined Investor podcast, are part of an affluent group that really don't know very much about the lived experience of people below the median in the U.S. And that obviously plays out in terms of priorities in public policy, the degree to which full employment becomes a priority. A second issue is what inequality does to even the wealthy, right? So I think a key point is that a lot of times discussions of things like inequality turn into accusations, like it's all about the rich bastards, right? But that's really not the right way to think about it. Mm-hmm. What we all, I think, ought to want is a decent society. Because if you look over all of human history, individual outcomes are a much smaller determinant of human happiness than the quality of the society in which you live. You could be the best Nigerian, and you know, maybe if you're the best Nigerian right now, the best meaning best off, affluent. I'm trying to say sort of best in moral terms. You could be mm-hmm. the most affluent Nigerian, but in a certain sense, except for to the degree that you can escape into the global elite rich person community, you know, you're still living in a world that is really messed up, and you're not really having a good life.
Well, actually, let me just say something. That this is a little bit of an opinion, because, and here's where I find this interesting, because today, the last 10 years, last 20 years, the ability to understand and to know that there are other people in different circumstances is a lot easier than it was, let's say, 50 years ago. Whereas 50 years ago, you know, the family unit in the U.S. would be much more closely defined. Travel wasn't as easy and you weren't able to be as mobile. And at the same time, you really didn't know what was happening maybe in another state till a few days later or maybe never. Now, what's interesting about that is that if you don't know about something, you know, if you don't know, if you don't have any not only knowledge, but inability to even comprehend, maybe that wouldn't be upset. You wouldn't be upset with that. And I'll give you an example of something. I just came back from Morocco just last week.
Sure.
And on one of the days that I was out, I was traveling. We went through the desert and we happened to upon a nomad. When I say village, it's a village of one. Okay, that's the whole point, right? So we went into we got out of our car and walked up, and the woman was very, very gracious and offered us tea. She was cooking a little hot pot in the back, offered us mint tea. We sat down. We spoke. We communicated. I shouldn't say spoke, but we communicated with her. She had two sons and three daughters, and her other son and another. I think the other son and the husband were out maybe grazing the sheep somewhere. Where, by the way, I could not even see where they were, so they must have been far away, and. You know, I wonder if she's all bummed out that we got a car and we got all this. I mean, you know, essentially it's a choice. So, you know, maybe it's not something that you or I would live with. Now, on the other hand, there's oppression. That's different, right? Oppression's different. You know, choice versus oppression. You know, you have a choice to live out in the sweltering heat of the desert, which I don't really get, okay? I don't get it, you know? But, okay, she seemed pretty happy, to be honest with you. And the kids were happy, and it was nice. On the other hand, you talk about oppression. That's a different circumstance. But where in the world is this utopia that you talk about where there's equality and there's kind of a, or at least a level of economic and morality on the economic side that would be something we could model ourselves on?
Well, there's certainly no utopias in the world, right? We live in, utopia means nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the United States of the 1980s and 1990s, 70s through 90s was significantly a better society.
Really?
Than the society that we live in now.
Well, it's interesting because we were very greedy. We were very greedy back then. I mean, the 80s were like greed central.
So don't get me wrong. The 80s were exactly where we got onto the sliding board that we're on now, to a kind of dangerous dystopia. But we had built up by the time the 70s and the 80s, we had built up affluence without having entirely lost social cohesion.
Mm-hmm.
And so this gets back to the Snowden stuff a little bit, to the NSA stuff. We were also at that time, that was the golden age of civil liberties in the U.S. Post Church Commission, post Watergate, right? All of a sudden, intelligence communities were really under some scrutiny. There was some accountability.
Mm-hmm.
And you can argue that it's sort of a post 9/11 thing, that it's a terrorism thing that has made all. I mean, the things that are happening now from a civil liberties perspective are things. I don't know about you. You know, we can all have our own impressions. But if someone in 1998, 1999 had said, "Oh, you know, the government is going to be collecting every bit of communication that they can possibly get their hands on, which will turn out to be the preponderance of it, and they will arrogate to themselves the right to decide whether or not they can listen to the communication or what kind of analysis they can do with that communication to an entirely secret court whose findings become law that cannot be disclosed." I would say that you're smoking something, right? I would say that's just not the United States of America.
Right. I'm with you, but on the other hand, you know, the world of today thinks that they can freely talk about whatever they want. Let's put it this way, that I am all in favor of, you know, from the terrorist point, you know, like, you know, kind of collecting information, all that good stuff and all that. Also, at the same time, I'm still maybe older and from a world that you just don't, you know, spew all your personal data everywhere. And I also have the understanding that what I say and what I write and what I do could come back one day. So I watch what I say, watch what I write, watch what I do, as opposed to the generation that came after and so forth. It feels that they could just do whatever they want, whenever they want, say whatever they want, and just retract it with a LOL.
Well, so I think that's missing something. The problem isn't what kids say on Facebook. Like, I don't care to what degree our culture becomes more or less exhibitionist. The social and political problem doesn't derive from kids saying stupid stuff and regretting it, and then maybe someone in the broad public, because they publicized, you know, their selfie that was embarrassing,
right,
can hold that against them, or, you know, it might make it hard for them to get a job. I mean, that matters. It matters. We're going to need to recalibrate our social mores and be tolerant of public misbehavior that previously we wouldn't have to tolerate because we would never have known about it. It would have been kept private. I think we've all in our lives growing up in our adolescence had things, even you and I from a generation before, there were things where we wouldn't want revealed on our CV that today, if we were a teenager, we might screw up, mm-hmm. and put it out on Facebook, mm-hmm. and then it's effectively on your CV. I think we'll deal with that problem as a society by some mix of people getting better about realizing that what they say on Facebook is not a conversation with friends, but a part of your permanent record. And on the other side of that, a general understanding, a shifting of the baseline that really there's a lot of indiscretion that we should tolerate. We should be able to realize that human beings are very entropic, and even very good human beings will have some outliers that are pretty bizarre and ugly, and they'll just be there on the
fringe. Right. I'm with you.
Yeah. So that's one issue. But the issue with the surveillance is that it's not what you say. It's what you do. It's who you communicate with, right? It's the what you can get from the metadata, the fact that everything that you buy with a credit card can be tracked, the kind of picture that can be created of a person and of the communities that they belong to, and the kind of ways that could be abused. And again, I don't think it's being too dramatically abused now, but when we're thinking about societies, we have to think about them as things evolving in time. And so my concern comes from a notion that, you know, goes back to the Constitution. The guys who wrote the Constitution, when they put in all those rights, they weren't really concerned that they were going to screw it up, right? They were ideologues, and, you know, they had just had a revolution against a nasty king, and they were mad about some things that the English had done, and they weren't going to do that stuff in the short term. Mm-hmm. They were idealists.
Right.
But they were smart enough to realize it's not enough to not be doing the stuff in the short term. If you want to develop a polity, you've got to create certain structures that make it very, very difficult, even in the face of strong incentives among groups that are in power, for those things to ever happen again.
Right. Well, so, yeah, I hear you. We'll see what happens. I mean, because at the end of the day, it looks like the governments are going to continue to provide for the haves and for the 1% and for the banks and for the players that busted the system to begin with. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that the belief is that, just like anybody else, the people that are in control are the ones that, you know, it's like the lawyers. The lawyers make the laws. So, you know, how do you fight that, right? I mean, that's the way it goes. You know, they're the ones writing the stuff, so you can't kind of go against them. It's like, how do you, you know, no lawyer will sue another lawyer. No politician is going to come in and do anything bad to, let's say, the banks, because the fact of the matter is they're going to be waiting for their opportunity to be a lobbyist or some kind of an employee spokesperson or whatever of the banks one day. It's kind of a very difficult thing to unravel right now. And I do understand that, I guess, you know, the essence of what you're saying makes some sense in terms of making a little bit more of a parody. But, you know, we'll have to see what happens. I want to jump to something else, but I want to ask you a couple of things. You know, you heard that Larry Summers is possibly trying to throw his hat in for the Fed chair. And I don't know what your thoughts are, but this is a guy who, you know, has been kind of wrong on so many different accounts and doesn't seem like he's the guy, you know, that could stand up to the others that have been in that position. Any thoughts on Larry Summers here on Fed chair?
Yeah, you know, my thoughts, like yours, I think are skeptical. And it's not, I have a general dislike of the group of people referred to as Reubenites. It's a tempered dislike because I don't think it was obvious in the 1990s that they were wrong about so much.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not to say that they were bad people, but I think it's pretty clear that group of people led us down a path that didn't work out for us very well. And what's troubling isn't so much that they did that, they screwed up. I mean, it is troubling that they screwed up. I wish we had institutions that screwed up less. But what's really troubling is that it seems to me that having pretty clearly screwed up as badly as they did, our political system should be doing a better job of doing, sort of in corporate terms, an external search for new leaders.
Yep.
Rather than sort of hiring from within the same elites that screwed up. And
and by the way, who are going to just, their policy will be the same as the policy they had before and before that and before that and before that, because there's no other knowledge that they bring to the table to change it. Which is exactly what's going on in Japan. Essentially what Japan has done is taken what we've done here by Bernanke and put that on not only steroids, but kind of juice the steroids and dropped a massive amount of stimulus and rhetoric, not to mention rhetoric. And more rhetoric, by the way, on top of the rhetoric. Dropping this huge amount of stimulus with the commentary that, hey, this is going to work. We know it's going to work. When in fact, in history, shown it doesn't work. And the big question still is, how does all this unwind? So what are your thoughts on this whole Japan, you call it the helicopter drop that they've done and all the things that are going on in Japan?
So I want to distinguish something. What they do in Japan, I've written and want to emphasize, is not the policy that I would call a helicopter drop. Some economists call a helicopter drop any money-financed fiscal spending.
Mm-hmm.
And so Japan has done over the last couple of decades, and is recently again doing a lot of government spending funded by effectively printing money, right, by mm-hmm. the central bank purchasing the bonds that the government is issuing. So I want to distinguish money-financed government spending from a helicopter drop, which in the original kind of Milton Friedman thought experiment was, hey, what if we literally had the central bank literally distribute money kind of randomly or to everybody? And I actually think a helicopter drop in the Milton Friedman thought experiment sense would be much, much better policy for Japan and for the U.S. than money-financed government spending.
Like dividends. Why didn't they just do a dividend plan? Instead of all this other stuff where they backdoor deals over here and where they bail out a bank over there, I just thought, why don't they just do dividends?
Exactly right. Right. So that's really the issue. The issue is corruption. And the issue of corruption, it's important to mention, isn't, again, people being bad, all those bastards. It's usually people being nice to one another. One of the things that's really important to understand about the financial crisis, about all those Reubenites, is that they were looking around at the world in which they lived in, and they were saving that world when they were behaving from, I think, your perspective, certainly my perspective, terribly corruptly in bailing out institutions and creditors as generously as they did, right? But from their perspective, letting things which from a capitalist perspective would be the right kind of discipline happen would mean that their world, the people who, the families of the children their children went to school with,
mm-hmm.
would suddenly not only be out of a job, but be out of a social class. The institutions that people's entire careers were built around, the sort of the things people always thought were always going to be there, they would all have shattered had mm-hmm. the government done the right thing. So the same thing is going on when we look at why policy is so bad. It's really because the people who are making policy live in a world where it's really important to continue what the people they interact with have become accustomed to. And so I think you see that in Japan in the way that, a huge problem with Japan's various efforts over the decades to stimulate its way out of the doldrums it's been in for such a long time is that it's done that with a lot of money financed government spending, but the money financed government spending has gone into infrastructure of favored firms, constructed by favored firms, often pretty pointless.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who are making those decisions, I think you and I would say that's obviously sort of corrupt and gross. But the people who are making those decisions are, I don't want to diminish it because it is really corrupt and gross, and you can really see it you know, you can really see it in the U.S. when we look at sort of, you know, farm bill policy and the way that.
Well, just look at another major solar firm, renewable energy firm, going bankrupt just last week. You know, we saw the big one in a couple of them, actually, you know, and billions of dollars going down the tubes because somebody has an idea, a deal, or some kind of a dream, you know, without looking at the actual, you know, P&L or the pro forma.
Well, so I guess I think we're probably going to disagree on stuff like the solar things. The solar things bug me when it comes out, if it comes out occasionally, that, you know, some firm got a subsidized loan from the government, and a lot of that had to do with the connections of somebody on the board to somebody in government. That's when I get really worried.
Yeah, no, I agree.
The fact that there were subsidized loans given to companies like solar companies that didn't have much of a balance sheet that a conservative investor wouldn't fund doesn't bug me because it's a venture capital model, right? And so I think there is a role for something like publicly subsidized venture capital. The issue really is, again, this corruption issue. Is that from my perspective, corruption very broadly understood, and again, I really want to emphasize it, to understand corruption properly, you have to understand that from the inside it doesn't look bad. Otherwise, you just have a cartoonish view. Now, I'm sitting here in Romania right now, and the basis, Romania is a country that is grappling. They're struggling, they're trying, but it's grappling with a lot of problems of corruption. But at the very micro level, the basis of corruption is the notion that people should help one another out reciprocally. And that idea just getting extended from the realm of the personal, where in the United States we consider it appropriate. We consider it appropriate that, you know, if a friend does something for you, you should do something for your friend. But in the United States, we have strong institutional norms that say, but, you know, that kind of thing should never cross institutional boundaries. You do something for your friend, he does something for you. But when your friend goes to work and he's in the role of a public official, he doesn't do that for you.
Right? Well, it's simple arm's length transactions. And it's, you know, if you're going to invest in a venture deal, you know what? At the end of the day, you need to say, hey, this is a deal that I really do think has some opportunity, rather than, you know, it's extra money because the government's got all this money they could spend, just, and I want to do this, so just throw it out there and let's see what happens. So, but I hear we could talk for hours on this, and I got to go, though, because we got to keep it short. And the audience sometimes gets a little bit peeved when we talk about politics. So that's why I want to mix it up with economics and all that. But I want to mention that, Steve, you could read his writing on interfluidity.com. We'll have his information on the show notes and all the things that you can get to him. And we're going to have you back. We'll talk about some other things in the future. I find it very interesting.
Okay, great. I enjoyed it.
Hey, Steve, have a good one, okay?
You too.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I know a lot of you don't like to hear, well, I mean, not a lot of you. Some people don't like to hear some of the politics and all that. But I thought it was really interesting. His writing is very, very clear, whether or not you agree with him or not, whether or not I agree with him or not. I just thought it was a good person who does a lot of his homework to really get an idea across and do his research on just a whole host of things. It may be a little bit heady for some. You know, he does use some big words there. But I think that there was some interesting things that we could all glean out of that. I want to mention a couple of things. J.P. Morgan comes out with a note that says they want to buy equities ahead of the second quarter earnings. He's listing 21 stocks that he thinks will be great. Semantic, Apple, Boeing. Oops. We didn't get to Boeing that much, you know, with that whole fire thing. But we'll see what happens next week. Now they say that it wasn't related to the battery. UPS also came out with a big warning last week, dropped the stock about 5.5%. But he has a lot of stocks near, like Target, Rockwell Automation, FXCM, Bank of the Ozarks, I believe that is. He has International Paper. I mean, nothing really too exciting on there in terms of names, but things that you've seen before. Also, I want to mention that there was a news item that came out over the weekend. Italy may have to seek about $12 billion in budget measures. That's kind of interesting. It's a lot of money for them, and it seems like we're getting back into some of this. Iceland also all of a sudden is having some issues. And Portuguese government pretty much almost disbanded last week when I was there. A couple of the main players just resigned, gone. Juncker, you remember him? He's possibly in trouble now, and he's resigning from Luxembourg. So that whole European cadre of smart fellas with the fast-talking mouths are getting in all sorts of trouble over there. I think also I want to mention, I had one more thing in here. Got a couple of different things. Okay, yeah, here it is. I want to mention that when I mentioned the steel companies, they're having a big problem. I want you to keep a look on retailers starting on Monday, and let's see how these play out. If, in fact, the consumer is continuing to spend. Realize that the University of Michigan index of confidence came in lower than expectations. Now, when you look at the details, though, at that, you saw that there's three components, but the ones that we look at is the current condition and future expectations. And they combine them all and then give you a number. Basically, what you saw was that the current situation's popped up. Everybody was really happy these days and what's going on right now. But at the same time, there was some concern about what's happening in the future. That's what brought it down. So when people start thinking about what's happening in the future and higher gas prices and all that, you got to wonder if they're going to keep their hands deep in their pockets or they're going to keep on spending. We're going to wrap it up about here. I think that's a great show. I enjoyed it. Again, I'm glad to be back, not going anywhere. In 6 years, that's the third show we missed on a regular basis that launches on Sundays. I hope you're telling your friends about the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I hope you're also leaving comments on iTunes, and I want to thank you for listening. And, you know, of course, write me about anything you want, and we'll see what we can do to either get on the air or answer your questions. Simply to ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We have some great guests coming up next week. Actually, I'm booked with guests for the next, I think, two and a half months. Usually we're only about 1 month out, but we have just a whole host of people coming on that are going to bring some good information, insight, and hopefully a couple of good ideas that can make us some money. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.